Pilot TV podcast this week, we are finally exposed to HBO's teen sex fest Euphoria, which doesn't make us feel old at all. We join Ashlyn B and Sharon Horgan for their new comedy, This Way Up, and pull on the spandex with Alison Brie for the third and final season of Glow. But wait, there's more. Not only do we have all that, but Gemma Chan and Dominic Savage swung by the studio this week to have a chat with me about I Am Hannah, which airs this week. I'm James Dyer, and welcome to the Pilot TV podcast, your essential guide to all things on the Gogglebox, and a show that's brought to you by one brash northern woman and two entirely interchangeable bald white men. So much so, in fact, that my own family, including my uncle and my mother, yes, it seems the entire Dyer clan has started listening to this podcast. Hi, guys. But I digress. The point is that neither my uncle nor my own mother can tell me and Boyd apart. And this is actually legitimately true because my mum came over to tell me this recently.
Wait a minute. I don't watch The Expanse.
So to that end, I am joined by my bespectacled alter ego, my mini-me, if you will, a man upon whom the fates bestowed the dubious honour of being my identical voice twin. It's Boyd Hilton.
Oh, like voice-wise? I thought you meant like they thought I was literally the same person as you and I liked all the same nerdy sci-fi stuff.
No.
Apart from us both being bald.
Yeah.
Well, I got glasses.
Yeah.
I'm much shorter than you.
Yeah.
And I'm not as much of a gigantic nerd. So
it's a voice thing. Apparently voice our voices thing. Are
really?
The same.
Where were you born and raised?
London. Well,
London.
Kind of,
not London.
No, not London. London. No, like home counties. Like,
right. Oh, okay. Yes. Wait a minute. Hold on.
Middlesex.
I've got an Essex kind of monotone of a voice.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
No, I'm Middlesex.
We've got Middlesex yes. monotone. God, that's terrifying.
Yeah. Terry's looking around saying, "You're
thank
all
God
fucking
Terry's
bald
here.
White man." You
God
sound
Terry's
same to me
with an interesting, authentic accent.
That's right. That's
this
right.
It's like watching like quite a tedious man argue with himself in the mirror.
Do you think we sound
alike,
Terry?
Watching you two have this conversation. No, not at all.
Close your eyes. Who's talking?
You are.
You've disproved that.
Right.
In one fell
you heard
swoop.
It here first. Terry instantly was able to tell that it was, in fact, me talking. So,
but I probably spend more time with you than both your mother and your uncle.
That is absolutely true. Yes. Is this working? Yes, it is. Okay. Yeah, okay, fine. All right, well, we disproved it. Boyd, you are no longer my identical voice twin. We clearly sound very much not alike. If you, as a listener, feel otherwise, do let us know. Of course, you've already heard her, but one of these things is not like the others, and our third musketeer will never be mistaken for either Boyd or myself. You'll know her by her distinctive dulcet tones, her willingness to fight about, well, anything, and her unseemly distaste for our beloved Banshee segment. It is, of course, Terry White.
Hello.
Hello. How you doing?
Really good. How are you?
Was that a posh voice? Were you doing posh voice there? Was that what that
really
was?
Really quite cool.
Were you being a bit southern? Hello. I'm Terry White.
Really quite good. Thank you, James.
Okay. Good, good, good. What have you been watching, Terry?
I have been watching... Okay. I've finally cracked.
Downton.
No, I started... Big Little Lies.
Oh, you did. Oh, how quickly your principles wash away.
So I couldn't help myself. I was stuck at home the other day and I was like, oh God, it's all sat there waiting for me. And I could feel it like calling to me from inside the television. Mm. Terry, Terry, Terry. And I'm enjoying it very much
it's
so
great,
far,
isn't it?
Which is really upsetting me as well. So
yeah,
I'd really not like
it?
To talk about
and
it.
And we've got the third chapter in the ongoing Big Little Lies controversy to talk about in news.
Oh, do we?
Oh, we could talk about it now.
Oh, I've missed this. No, let's do it now.
Okay, because well, you know Kidman and Witherspoon went on the record.
Oh, did they?
Yeah,
I completely missed this.
So at the they did a chat with a magazine and they said, they outright denied that anyone had not been communicated with properly, is what they said.
So they're not disagreeing that she lost creative control.
No.
They're just saying she knew about it.
Yeah, they're saying effectively she was never promised creative control. So they said what the HBO head said about the whole thing was beautiful, which I felt was a really weird, very actor-y way of talking.
Mm.
He said beautiful, like as in, I guess the reference to that said without, he kept saying without Andrew Arnold, there would be no second season, which is one, you know, so they emphasized that. Kidman said, he said it beautifully. That's why we had him handle it. So So they also talked about why they haven't commented thus far. And Witherspoon added, in our minds, there is no controversy. We just love the show. We had a great time doing it. There's a lot of misinformation and no credited sources on any of the information. This was an incredibly collaborative process for all of us. And the idea that anyone was mistreated and not communicated with is completely not true.
Ooh.
So it's interesting. I mean, I've not changed my mind, but I still think it must have been horrendous what Andrew Arnold's gone through.
Mm.
But
yeah, and if it was, I mean, I trust IndieWire's reporting, I have to say. I think you can't, the way that news reporting works, if anybody knows, is not always on named sources, actually.
Of course, yeah.
So I think that kind of is unfair to kind of cast a lack of credibility on it due to that. It's a very traditional way of reporting out news, actually. Yeah. And the fact that Andrea Arnold still hasn't commented, I can't imagine it would be wildly fabricated and not in any way true.
Of course, yeah,
because if it wasn't true, she'd have been like, no, this isn't true at all.
Yeah. Yes, because she declined to comment at all times. Presumably, if she'd have been presented with something that was distinctly without merit, then she would have said that.
Yeah, and intriguingly, I think they do want to do another season.
I think they will.
Yeah, I think they will as well. Because they talk about how, well, when you get, we won't talk about the ending, but they talk about how they wanted, that for various reasons, they want that, you know, they want to carry on, yeah. And, you know, everyone will love it if they do, except maybe Andrew Arnold.
Yeah.
We'll see.
What have you been watching, Boyd?
I've had a very kind of non-pilot TV week of TV consumption. I've done, you know, when Terry goes off and watches like 18 episodes of CSI?
Oh, yes.
My equivalent of that is watching like factual stuff. And not only have I watched Mortimer and Whitehouse gone fishing, which is one of my favourite shows, in which Bob Mortimer and Paul Whitehouse literally go fishing and talk about being old geezers who have medical problems, considering I am an old geezer, probably with medical problems. I totally relate to that. That's a brilliant show. That's on BBC Two on Fridays. I also went to see Britain's Got Talent, The Champions, live earlier in the week.
Boyd.
Yeah, right. And I mean, I was doing it professionally because I was doing a feature following David Williams around. And I got to hang out with all the people there, Simon Cowell, Anton Dekker. But the big revelation of the whole thing, it was worth it, honestly. I know you haven't heard of any of these people, James.
I really haven't.
But Declan Donnelly of Ant and Dec fame, who is one of the most famous
Antoine
people.
Deck. Yes.
One of the most famous people in the country, told me that when he gets the chance, he listens to this podcast.
Really?
Are you sure he wasn't just saying that?
He wasn't just saying it. He said it's when he goes on holiday, when he's away, when he's not working every single day, he listens to the podcast. And he actually said he's going away now for a few weeks and he will listen to the podcast. So shout out to Deck.
Hello, Antor Deck.
Yeah, Deck.
Is this going to be one of those things where Deck will now go on Twitter and say, oh, the Pilot TV podcast is brilliant. Love that Boyd Hilton and Terry White. Really great stuff.
I mean, I expect
just
and
like
hope
James
so.
Corden.
Yeah, absolutely fully expect and hope so. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Cheers, Deck.
Effectively.
I watched the Eddie Murphy Comedians and Cars Getting Coffee, but I'm not going to talk about it. It was very good.
Yeah,
what I'm going to say. What I want to talk about, I watched this week the second part of the I Am series, I Am Kirsty, which I had been putting off because I thought it would be traumatic. Oh my God, was it traumatic. So this, and I texted Terry as soon as I seen this, this was incredible, an incredible hour of television and the single most depressing hour of television I have ever spent. So this was, you're going to hear from Dominic Savage later on in this show when we talk about the third one, much less depressing, I Am Hannah. But so this is Samantha Morton as a, you know, as a working sort of single mum who finds herself in extreme financial difficulty and is terrorized by Thoros of Mir and ends up having to turn to sex work in order to support her children. And like we talked about this, and I talked about this a little bit on Twitter. I think the acting in this is incredible, and it's an incredibly powerful story. And the fact that it is not based on Samantha Morton's own life, but it is based on people that she has had contact with, you know, that there's a realness to it, there's an honesty to it, and there's a sense that, and Boyd, as someone who's interchangeable with myself, you know, middle class people such as ourselves, born of, dare I say it, a certain amount of privilege, like have no conception of the kind of desperate poverty that this episode depicts. And you know, it's not like I had some sort of Damascene conversion from watching, because we've talked about this sort of stuff quite a lot, but it really hit home for me how far outside a lot of people's experience this kind of thing is. And when, you know, people read the Daily Mail and things like that, it's very easy to kind of see that caricature of people and to, you know, you talk about the demonization of the working classes and whatnot and, you know, reality TV. But
the sort of the idea that somehow poverty is self-inflicted and somehow there's always a way out of it if you just, do you know what I mean? And this showed that kind of a person in a situation where there was just no way out of this situation and the hopelessness that comes from that. And I found it incredibly affecting. I really did. That said, it is absolutely not a lol fest of any kind. So, I mean, Terry, you love misery porn, so this is your bread and butter.
I do, but I tell you what you're reacting to, right, is there are so few genuine depictions of life in poverty in this country on either television or screen. Ken Loach is pretty much the only person doing it in cinema. And what's astonishing about it is it's unflinching, but it's not without warmth and empathy. And empathy for me is the real difference, which is there are plenty of programs in this country on poverty, on the underclass, on, and we're not talking about the working class here. We are talking about people who are below the poverty line. You've got 4 million children in this country living in poverty, and the representations of people living in poverty on our tellies are mainly disgusting and far removed from reality and actually devoid of any empathy. And I think what Dominic Savage has done in collaboration with Samantha Morton here, in a completely different way from I Am Nicola last week, and from in a completely different way from I Am Hannah, which is going to be next week, he has created a authentic, true, nuanced and empathetic portrayal of a woman stuck in those circumstances. And it is unlike anything I have seen depicting that woman, that life and those children. And I think it's remarkable for that. But I think it makes for very difficult viewing because we like to think that that doesn't really exist in this country, let's be honest.
So that, in my slightly bumbling Hugh Grant-esque way, was what I was trying to say. Thank you, Terry.
Can I just say, I watched it as well, and I completely agree, but it is that's what I kept thinking. How rarely do we see these people on TV? I mean, you see them in factual shows on Channel 5, and with the skew, I'm not necessarily just in Channel 5, I'm just saying that's a different thing. And you can almost, and it's interesting because you almost go back to Kathy Come Home.
Yeah.
And then what's the 60s?
Yep.
You can remember these things and not maybe the odd Mike Lee piece, you know, down there. You literally can remember the handful of things. Do you remember we did that thing, didn't we, on BBC Two? Was it late last year, which was about those people having to go to a kind of halfway house place?
Oh, yes,
Which, and they literally, you can think of these isolated moments where people living in actual poverty are depicted in any way humanely. In TV fictional and TV scripted drama, and it's unbelievable. But you see middle class and posh people week in, week out, every single story is about them. So that's that, and it is a brilliant show, completely 100%. That did absolutely brilliant.
But I felt like it sounds really ridiculous, but there was a part in this, like, I almost wish that something, not necessarily even this, but something like this was almost like required viewing in private schools. You know what I mean? I just think, and this is what people always talk about the university experience, it's really important to socialize and to meet and have contact with people who are outside of your, you know, socioeconomic or ethnic religious group. So you meet other people and you understand other stories, because otherwise you grow up until that sort of very narcissistic age in your sort of late teens, early 20s, where you only know one narrative and you have no understanding of what life is like outside that narrative. And I don't think that makes for a particularly well-rounded member of society. And I don't think it qualifies you to, for example, vote. Do you know what I mean? I think you need to have an understanding of all sections of society to really see how we fit into it. It's possible we've digressed a little bit away from the TV podcast that we set out to make today. But hey-ho, there's my little bit of socio-political pontificating. So that segues us almost seamlessly into Funny or Dire. The
amazing
weekly death match between small screen comedy and the grim shroud that is My Happy Face. This week's patient comes to us via Adam Snape and is, drumroll, Silicon Valley, Season 1, Episode 8, Optimal Tip-to-Tip Efficiency. So, I've never seen Silicon Valley before. This was my first encounter with it. So this is the eighth part of the first season. It's an ongoing storyline. I don't have the first fucking clue what was going on for the beginning of this. But then very quickly it became clear I don't think I really needed to. Like, it's just nerdy people doing nerdy things. Yeah. And when you get to it, they're in a competition. It doesn't really matter how they got there. Someone got punched a week before. It doesn't matter. I did actually laugh in this. I've got to confess. I can't say I found the whole thing really funny as a rule, but there was a moment where I did laugh.
Do you think this is a product of its time, right? Because you know that I have also never seen it. Mm. And one of my really good friends has always said to me, you must watch Silicon Valley. I think you'd really like it. I haven't.
I would, knowing you as I do, I would never have made that recommendation.
So I literally had that reaction. I was like, 10 minutes in going, this is loads of geeks making geeky jokes. Is that kind of it for the entire hour? And then I was thinking, is this kind of, because it's obviously
it's
very...
it just felt like an hour for you.
Very specific time, you know, like with the kind of the growth of Silicon Valley and that whole kind of this birth of the tech entrepreneur, the Mark Zuckerbergs before he became evil, who's just a bit of a insular, introverted geek who kind of can't really talk to people, can't talk to girls. All of those kind of tropes around those tech bros. Who are people who've been desperately socially unsuccessful for their entire lives and then use their massive brains to become financially and economically successful, but still struggle with the same social kind of difficulties. Mm. And so I was like, maybe this would have been funnier and felt more relevant 5, 6, 7 years ago.
Yeah, because I mean, it's 2014, so it is literally 5 years
ago. I think
the
problem with this is, so I have watched Silicon Valley, pretty much all of it, and I really like it, but it has kept up with the times as it's gone on. But so subsequent series, they pivot to video. They pivot to video chat. Then they pivot to creating an alternative internet, kind of without any government interference. Yeah. And then they go on, cryptocurrency they dealt in the last series, they created, which went horribly wrong. And what it does, the main comedic force of it, which kind of was a little bit shown in this episode, is every time you think they're either going to be really successful with one of these things, it ends up going completely wrong. Mm. Or every time you think it's going to go completely wrong, it ends up being a massive success. And you're never sure which way it's going to go. And I like that. That's the kind of device that works quite well.
Yeah.
But having said that, I watched this and I thought this is, and I always say this every week, I hate saying this to our choosers of these shows, but I think, no, not this episode. Again, you can go for a much more recent, and I think the show got better and better and better. Yeah. And recent episodes were much zingier and much more up to date and modern and current, because they really work hard at keeping it current and moving it on. But having said that, it is a show about a bunch of bloke nerds being bloke nerds, and as we did last week with Peep Show, it is that is what it is. But it is a very well written and performed.
Lest we forget, the entire plot of this revolves around the ratio of a compression algorithm.
Right.
So, let's, this is not sexy.
And unlike, say, The Big Bang Theory, which, kind of manages to make that stuff seem completely mainstream and accessible to its huge mainstream audience, this doesn't even bother with that.
No, of course it doesn't.
And this is hugely popular in Silicon Valley amongst these people. They love this shit. Because it's uncompromising use of all the jargon and everything.
Yeah.
So you kind of just let it, flow. I don't even understand what the fuck's going on.
I have no idea.
Yeah, no idea. It's still, I think it is a really good show that I've loved. But this episode, I would not have picked this episode.
But that bothers me. That's just a personality trope when I don't understand bits and I can't just let it wash over me and go with the flow.
I find that even if you don't understand, for example, and I can't even remember what it's called, but there's a specific scale by which they measure compression algorithms. I mean, obviously it helps that I'm kind of a nerd and I know what a compression algorithm is, but I didn't know what that scale was, but I understood broadly speaking what they were saying in terms of compression and what they had achieved. And
this was fucking made for you. Yeah, okay. What are you talking about? I may have laughed. Okay. Says James, who was probably doubled up for 30 minutes.
It wasn't that funny, this episode. It was quite dramatic, but it wasn't that funny in terms of...
Except, and I don't know what this says about me, the bit that made me laugh was not... So there's a bit when they're in the hotel room and one of them proposes a mathematical formula for determining the amount of time it would take to, shall we say, pleasure every male member of the audience.
Yeah, now that set piece scene was, guess why it was chosen, this episode was chosen.
Can only assume.
I've seen that done before, you see. That's the only problem with that scene, where people are kind of sorting out, what it'd be like to jostle off, numbers of people.
Jostle off?
Yeah. Yeah. It's kind of a bit that is you see done, And so I didn't even think that was as funny as
that
it could
was
have
the
been.
Bit that made me laugh. Made me laugh is when the socially awkward guy who's giving the presentation describes it in really vague terms, but does the hand motion when he's talking about
that was
it.
Fun,
and
fun.
That made me laugh.
So can we just get into detail here? So how many times did you laugh?
Once.
And did you laugh out loud?
No, it was another like that. Like an exhalation of mirth. So, there was no belly laugh or guffawing.
Okay.
So it was just that. So it passes on the technicality. So it just scrapes through. But honestly, it's like, is Silicon Valley funny? I couldn't tell you. Was this episode funny? Really? Not really. But it's well
really
written, and
really.
It did actually make
really
me laugh.
Not
so,
really.
You know,
really.
I will say that that Adam Snape does just about scrape through with this one. Well done, Adam. But yeah.
We should probably try and do something next week that is not a group of blokes.
No, okay. Funnily enough, next week's nomination comes from Ilan Preskovsky and his New Girl, season 4, episode 5.
I mean,
Landline.
Some may say that New Girl is kind of a fetishized version of male version
what,
of female
Manic Pixie
human.
Dream Girl?
Yes, yes.
I'm just saying it's called New Girl. There's a girl in it, so it's no longer a bunch of guys talking about wanking each other off.
I'm very much enjoying how you're trying to get out of this on a technicality by going, there's a girl in it. A, there's a girl in the title, and B, there's a girl in the programme.
Yeah, yeah, so it's all good. Hashtag feminism, hashtag fuck the patriarchy. Right, if you'd like to nominate your own female-led comedy for this section, then do fire the series and episode name at me via Twitter, at James C. Dyer, and I will add it to the mix. Shall we get on to this week's news, which we will do live since I've not had a chance to look at anything?
Do it live? We always do it live.
Well, no, because normally I would have looked at stories in advance.
Yeah, you just forgot. I'm now surprised you haven't seized upon the Joss Whedon.
I'm looking at it now.
Oh, well, there you go.
Yeah, the Nethers.
The Nethers, which whenever anyone says the Nethers, I can see the Nethers.
Yeah, I think Joss Whedon's Nethers, and I'm like, oh, good God.
But
I am very confused by this. But can you walk us through it?
The
quite
Nethers.
Quite dense.
The Nethers.
The Nethers is described as an epic science fiction drama about a gang of Victoria women with unusual abilities, and they're on a mission to change the world.
I mean, of course.
Yeah.
What else would a group of Victorian women with unusual abilities
be doing?
I
think it's going to be like a kind of, I don't know, like steampunky thing. Anyway, but the cast has been announced as of yesterday, and it is pretty fucking impressive. Olivia Williams.
Yeah.
James Norton.
Yes.
Nick Frost.
Yes.
Tom Riley.
Yes.
Ben Chaplin. Pip Torrens. Obviously, I'm now going down the every single person. And the lead, which we talked about weeks and weeks ago, is Laura Donnelly, who's really good as well. So I'm excited about the cast.
Yeah, yeah. So, you know, Joss Whedon's Nethers looking exciting.
Yeah.
Can't wait to see them.
I mean, mainly because it's got two Buffy writers on it, let's be honest.
Always. So there was some Walking Dead spin-off news. Sorry, Terry, did you instantly fall asleep?
Yeah. Yeah.
I've actually been ploughing through Fear the Walking Dead and continue. It's not improved.
James, why do you do this to yourself?
I'm not sure what was going on there. So there was a kind of a video teaser thing that showed kind of a trio of the show's stars, and they're talking about leaving a safe world that they grew up in to find the truth about their world, which involves zombies, and that's all I know. So there's gonna be Walking Dead spin-off, another one, and it's gonna have zombies in it. There you go, something you didn't know before.
I want to talk about a lovely thing that the creators of Orange is the New Black did to coincide with the finale. So this has got no spoilers in it about what happens in the finale if you haven't quite made it to the end. But there is a storyline within it which is about Tasty setting up this kind of fund for prisoners. And at the end of the season, a kind of a blank card comes up, and on it, it says it has a telephone number, it has a URL, and it turns out that they have set up, in real life, the Poussey Washington Fund. Mm-hmm. As everybody knows, that is named after Samira Wiley's character who died in season 4. And it is a crowdsourcing campaign to support criminal justice reform and immigrant rights charities, with a particular focus on female prisoners. I think there's 8 charities involved, and all the money will be split. And I just think it's amazing. We talked when we reviewed the show about how they're kind of tackling ICE and what's happening with immigrants in America at the moment. And there's always been a real political bent to this show, and I just think it's really lovely of them to go out in such a meaningful way. The end.
Yes.
Guess what else happened?
Something not as important and entirely fictional and set in space.
Oh, no, something very similar to what you're discussing.
Oh, go on.
Amazon made an announcement. They have officially renewed The Expanse for a 5th season. Yes! Belters rejoice. Haven't even aired season 4 yet, and already, boom, there's a 5th season.
Did you just do boom and a finger click?
Yes, yes. I'd have done a fist pump, but this is an audio product. So that's the thing that's happening. James Wan, did you hear, is doing an I Know What You Did Last Summer TV series. You're producing it. So that's a thing.
That's a good idea.
Yeah, that is a good idea.
I like that.
Apparently, so this is going to be a TV treatment, but it was originally going to be a reboot film from Mike Flanagan. Haunting of Hill House, Mike Flanagan.
And Dr. Sleep, Mike Flanagan.
Indeed, indeed. So that's a thing.
Did you see the announcement of details of the next Agatha Christie, Sarah Phelps serial, The Pale Horse? They've announced the full cast. Rufus Sewell is in it.
Yes.
Kaya Scodelario off of Skins.
Case Scodders.
Bertie Carvel off of Dr. Foster. Sean Pertwee is the detective character. Henry Lloyd Hughes out of Killing Eve. And many more. But the most exciting cast member is... Have you looked at it, the list?
No.
James? Oh. Rita Tushingham. The legend who is in A Taste of Honey way back when. Rita Tushingham, genuine acting legend, is in this...
Boyd, I love your hark back to the days of old.
Thank you. And obviously, this is genius Sarah Phelps' new show. She will be featuring the next issue of Pilot TV Magazine, by the way.
Amazing.
And it's always a treat. And it's the plot, by the way, this is all you need to know. The Pale Horse follows Mark Easterbrook as he tries to uncover the mystery of a list of names found in the shoe of a dead woman.
Oh, my God.
I mean,
it's going to be Rufus Sewell. If Rufus Sewell is in this, he's the killer.
Don't say that.
It's true. It's Rufus Sewell.
Okay. It's probably Rufus Sewell.
It's definitely Rufus Sewell.
Okay.
A little bit of news came out about The Continental, which is the John Wick spin-off series. It's going to be set way, way, way before the film, so it's a proper prequel thing. It's also looking like it won't now arrive until after John Wick Chapter 4, which is 2021. So we're going to have a bit of a wait for that one. Sorry. Anything else?
No.
I'm scrolling through news.
That's enough news.
Who needs more news? We've had more than enough news as it is anyway. So let's park news there and instead move on to a guest. We have a guest, two guests, in fact. So you'll have heard our review of I Am a few weeks ago, and you'll have heard us banging on about I Am Kirsty a few short minutes ago. So within, like, you've already seen the first two, the final installment of this series, I Am Hannah, airs on Channel 4 this Tuesday and stars Gemma Chan as... well, Hannah, a 30-something woman dealing with the horrors of modern dating and the pressures to find the one. Gemma and show creator Dominic Savage popped by for a chat about the episode this week, and this is how it went. Welcome to the Pilot TV podcast, Dominic Savage, Gemma Chan. The I Am series is in full flow at the moment. We've seen I Am Nicola, we've seen I Am Kirsty, and the last installment, and my personal favourite, I Am Hannah, is on Tuesday night on Channel 4. So this is an episode that you developed together. And I mean, it's an exceptional series, which anyone who follows me on Twitter will know I've been banging on about, but it's quite unusually made. How did that kind of come together?
I think it was from a desire to make drama differently. I mean, I've always enjoyed making different kind of work, really, from the norm. And I thought on this, it would be really nice to work actually with an actor from the beginning. So this is what it's about. It's about a story that is going to be played by the actor that's the lead, that is their story, really, something that the actor can literally inhabit in a unique and full way. And the process of meeting and talking to actors, in the case with Gemma, we'd worked together before. Mm-hmm. So we went through a process of just deciding on what we were going to do, really. You know, we talked about a lot of things. And then we came to the conclusion this was the absolutely right story to tell, an important story and something that's rarely told.
Yeah, from my point of view, I was very keen to work with Dominic again, and I was very excited when he approached me to collaborate on this, because it's very rare to be given that opportunity to be part of that creative process from such an early stage and to say, right, what story do we want to tell? And also to completely center a woman and a woman's experience is unfortunately still quite a rare thing.
Sure.
So that was really exciting, and we started talking about what we wanted to say. We talked about quite a few different ideas that started off in quite a different place to where we ended up. But I mean, I had from quite early on had an inkling that I wanted to do something around the idea of the pressure on women to settle down, to start a family, you know, whether or not women can or can't start a family, and the expectation that comes both from the external kind of situation, but also from within.
You're right. It is something that doesn't get talked about. Like the trope of the biological clock is something that turns up endlessly in TV and in film, but it's not normally handled in this way. You know, not just sensitively, but kind of exploring the sort of the broader ramifications of choice, of kind of expectation. What was the sort of watershed moment? What was the thing that sort of triggered this?
Can I say what we talked about initially?
Go on.
Which was Dominic's idea at the beginning, that it was going to be about a woman who wasn't in a settled relationship, but she was dead set on having a child. And then she goes down the road of artificially inseminating herself and having a baby, which I think would be incredibly interesting and a very valid story to tell. But I was more drawn to... a kind of grey area. I was drawn to the idea of playing someone who felt a bit more ambivalent about the whole thing, who wasn't quite sure what she wanted. Maybe a bit linked to some of my own feelings or conversations that I've had around that area with my friends. And so we went, gradually went towards that direction.
I mean, that's the beauty of working this way, is that you start with this idea, but then working with Gemma, it evolved into something that then became very important to her as well. And then obviously it's then about exploring it, and as we start to make it, different things come in and different ideas sort of occur to you as you're doing it, and they are provocative for us all. I think these scenes that we embark upon provoke us and make us feel, and certainly we felt a lot, didn't we, during the shoot? There's a lot of feelings going on.
Yeah.
That's how I love making work, really.
Well, it comes across, doesn't it? Like there's a real sort of tangible sense of emotion on screen in all three of these episodes. Like it's quite gut-churning. I mean, happily, this is not quite as traumatic as the previous one, for example. But still, there's a lot. There's so much emotion going on screen. Mm. And is that, you know, partly drawn from the fact that it is very personal, that you've helped to kind of create that and channeled some of yourself into this character?
I think that's definitely part of it. I think it's also to do with the way that that Dominic works and the way he films. Mm. I should say that there is a broad story outline, but all the dialogue is improvised by the actors. So it feels very immediate, unpredictable. We shot it over 10 days in a very intense period, and you're completely immersed in it. And it's kind of terrifying, but also very, very freeing. And when it works, and I've watched the other two films as well, I think there's an incredible kind of raw emotional power to Dominic's work, and that's really the beauty of it and why I love working with him.
You sort of get lost in it too. That's the other thing. It's an interesting thinking back to that 2 week shooting. It was like, it was so intense and so all encompassing, and all, it's like you're living it.
Because we were feeling our way through it day by day as well. And even though we knew roughly what had to happen, like we knew that my character was going to go on a date and it wasn't going to end well, but we didn't know exactly how we were going to get from A to B. And I certainly didn't know that some of the things that happened were going to happen. Like one of the dates ended quite explosively. And we did takes where it didn't end like that, and then other ones that really kind of erupted, and actually, you know, that was the beauty of it, that we would do these very long takes and it would go differently each time. We'd go back and reset and then say, let's try it again and see what happens. So it's very intuitive and very exploratory, the process. And I felt definitely by the end of the 2 weeks, I felt like I'd lost a layer of skin. I felt like my nerves were all on the outside. I had to kind of go away from it for a bit and not speak to you for a bit, Dominic. And just kind of, put it to one side, because it was very intense.
I mean, you mentioned it being terrifying. It sounds that and so much more. Yeah. I'd imagine as an actor, not being one, well, not since sixth form at school, that there's some security to be found in knowing your lines and just being on it and knowing it and being prepared. And I suppose nothing can really prepare you for a day of shooting something like this.
Yeah.
And it has to come from you, Gemma, in a way that, you know, Minerva clearly doesn't.
Yes, that's right. I think when you have a script, I mean, not to say that when you have something scripted that it can't be emotionally truthful. Yeah. Of course it can be. But it is, in some ways, it's a safety net. Those are the words you're going to say and you're going to, you know, that's it. Whereas in this work, you know, everything's got to come from somewhere that feels very real, or not. And if things don't work, you feel very exposed. You've got to be able to feel, very open, but also, you know, completely silly and humiliated sometimes. And it feels just very very exposing, for lack of a better word.
I mean, that sounds a lot like dating generally, so actually, that's quite true to life.
Yes,
this does deal with, I mean, and there have been lots of books written on this subject, but sort of the nature of modern dating, app-based dating, is demoralising and awful, and just it's a hellish sort of conveyor belt of, you can tell I'm speaking from personal experience, but do you know what I mean? And I think that really comes across in some of these encounters, like the one in the park, which lasts of 5 minutes.
Yeah.
And you're just like, I've never seen it, and thankfully I've not been on it, but that date has totally happened somewhere.
I know someone who's had a similar experience to that. Yeah, so most of the, I've not gone through, thankfully not gone through any of those awful experiences that Hannah has gone through, but I've heard really successful stories as well, we should say. It's not all bad.
Apparently,
there are some real horror stories out there, and that's the nature of it. So you just don't really know, you know, what you're going to get, and you see some of that reflected.
Well, it's interesting because in each case the actors cast, I like the idea, because I obviously spoke to them about their approach to it and all that, and I just thought there was also something very surprising about what they were going to bring to it that you didn't know. That was the point, you know. Gemma didn't know what their angle was, you know. Mm-hmm. So that's what makes something very almost combustible and interesting, that as it would be as well. That's exactly as it would be on a date, or whatever's been said leading up to it is not what it's going to actually be. It's going to be what it's going to be. So, and you can't predict it. And I think that again plays to the strength of working this way. Mm. You know, if that had been all kind of worked out to the T, you wouldn't have had that kind of energy about
danger.
It. Yeah.
I should say that. So Dominic likes to keep it quite, you know, the people that I would have had pre-existing relationships with, I would have contact with before. So, for example, Sarah, who played my mum, she and I corresponded beforehand, and at least, you know, marked out some, you know, biological facts of where we lived, what our relationship was like, relationship with grandmother and various things. So we had a framework before we went into it. Whereas the men that I went on these dates with, I met them as if for the first time being filmed on a date. So it was very...
It was important to keep them apart.
He tried to keep us apart. Don't speak to each other before we filmed.
That's right, yeah. So that's what I enjoy, that actually you there's a sense in which you're seeing something which is, it isn't documentary, we know that. It's drama, but it doesn't feel like it's all kind of, it feels like you're watching real life as well.
There's a voyeurism to it, absolutely.
Yeah.
And the lighting in particular helps with that. So you used all natural light in this.
Yes.
And that really comes across.
Yeah.
Really comes across.
And handheld.
Yeah.
Because what I like is to keep the business of filmmaking as kind of minimal as possible. Because, of course, with that, I mean, I don't really like films where there are performances as such. Mm. You watch a film, I mean, you know, they have their place and you can enjoy it. But what I want is to feel is totally, I believe this person, I believe in this character. So the mechanisms of filmmaking all interfere with that, you know, because there's process and there's takes and retakes and lighting and this and fuss and, you know, and that for me is just a death to creativity.
Yeah.
I mean, it isn't obviously always, but I just enjoy this absolutely visceral edginess that comes with this process.
Mm. It was really refreshing for me, for coming from doing the productions that I was on, being, you know, hundreds of people there. I couldn't hope to remember, you know, every single person's name because there are hundreds.
Marvel movie.
And you know, green screen and, you know, everything being so fragmented, to really go into the other end of the scale, to having just the bare minimum of crew, barely any kind of, you know, hair and makeup or no artificial lighting, and just, working with the other actor, with Dominic, and just, you know, keeping it very, very low key. And I absolutely loved it.
And what extent, you mentioned there's an outline to the scene, is it literally just they meet on a date, they're in the park, it doesn't go well, like, is it, how much detail is in it?
Like I mean, you know, what I like to do is put as much, you know, it's a document that's for the actor, really. It's not for anyone else.
Mm.
So where I think that it's giving too much and I don't want to overdo what's going to happen, then I'll keep it really, really minimal. Other times it's important to kind of describe as much as possible as it's almost like a document of hope as well. And I sometimes see, I do see the things that I write in a scene as provocations.
Yeah.
There's many little ideas there that we can take or not, can use or not. But we, you know, the story is very important. The narrative is very important. The kind of the way in which it progresses and all that stuff is there. But what I don't want to do, I don't want to limit the scenes. That's the point. I think writing can, you know, in some ways can enable, but also limit. Whereas, so yes, it's detailed when it needs to be, but not when I think it's going to actually overimpose on what the actor is going through.
And and yet the dialogue really lands. There's a particular scene when you're having drinks with a friend and Hannah's saying that, you know, so many people she knows settles for just the next guy they see because they just want to have kids and she's not prepared to do that. But then the, sort of the addendum to that, but she's terrified of fucking it up. Mm. And there's like, it's very, very, I mean, it really, really sings.
Oh, thank you. I can barely remember saying that. It was, I was just, it came, I think, in the midst of a very intense day and I clearly came bursting out of somewhere.
Well, it was the thing. This is the beauty again of working this way, is that when you get to a point where you know the moment is right, where, as you say rightly, we've been going through a lot of stuff, and suddenly it feels like some of the kind of really core elements of the film. You know, I always want it to come out in the way that's right and appropriate and real and you know, in terms of the filming process. And it felt like this is it. This is the moment. And in talking with her friend on the sofa, it felt like the conditions were perfect for it.
Yeah.
So we pushed that envelope at that point. And Gemma was just in that right place, and it flowed in a really interesting and totally centered way. And that's, again, you know, you try to write all that down, it becomes a performance. It's a performance.
Yeah.
You know, but that was...
No, it definitely came from, you know, where my character was and, you know, having been so immersed in her for however many days of filming, and it just came from that emotional need to express her frustration. And that was really all that I wanted from this, that, you know, that I just really hoped that everything that we did, as much as possible, that I would be completely... in the moment. I didn't want anything I did to feel kind of, you know, a performance. I wanted it to feel very truthful. So I hope we succeeded there.
Well, that speech feels like the spine of the story, doesn't it? That's ultimately, and I think that's an existential issue that I think a lot of people face.
Yeah, and not just for women as well. I should say, I think men experience these pressures in a slightly different way. Maybe the biological clock is not quite, that doesn't give that same pressure. But definitely I know men who are just as kind of, you know, worried and anxious about their life choices. It's not easy. And there's definitely not just one way to do things either. And we're kind of grappling with that choice. And fear of future regret, I think, is a huge thing. I have that massively. Gosh.
Yeah.
Trying to predict what you're going to regret least in the future.
Absolutely. I think you're absolutely right. I think it does. And I think there's so much social pressure, you know, of what is expected of you, that somehow, like, if you're a woman and you're approaching 40, you don't have children, that you have quote unquote failed somehow, or you know you have not completed the game that is life. And it's just, it's so absurd.
It is absurd. I mean, I think it's wonderful now that we do have more choice, and in the way that maybe previous generations just wasn't even remote. You really would be considered a freak if you didn't conform. Whereas now we're still adjusting, but you know, there was also that research quite recently about the fact that single childless women rank very highly on the happiness scale, which I thought was great. But it was interesting how many people kind of got defensive about that, or refused to believe it.
And married couples were really low, weren't they?
Really low. I know. But then again, but I know many happily married couples as well. So I think the main thing for me, the takeaway from doing this and from watching the other two stories, was that we should try and be a lot less judgmental about other people's life choices. And someone else's life choice is not a reflection on our own happiness. You know, we can get quite funny about the fact that if we see someone else, they've chosen something different, they seem to be happy, but that means I can't be happy. But it's not true. It's not a zero-sum game. There are many different ways to live your life, and we should be a bit more forgiving of others and ourselves.
Yeah. Like, there's a scene with Hannah and her friend who's just had a baby, which is quite resonant. And I was just thinking, oh, terrible, smug baby boy. Hater, get new friends. No, just about the actress playing it. But it's a person. That's a type of person who are very proud of themselves.
The beauty of that is it comes from an absolutely genuine and real place.
Yeah.
In the actor playing that's her baby. She's a mother. She genuinely felt that way, you know, and I, that's what I loved about it, is that the, and that's what you responded to as well, that actually she had found something, you know, and she might have been cynical before, but suddenly having this baby had made some, genuinely made, given her something that she'd never expected to feel. And I like that. That was something that was, that wasn't manufactured, you know, although there's an example actually with the script. I wanted that to be the case. I wanted it to be something that Hannah was experiencing and feeling stuff from, because it was genuine.
Well, when you watch it back, when you look at it, I mean, do you, does it feel different to watching other stuff you've done? Like, do you see more of yourself in this?
If I'm being completely honest, the first time that I watched this back, I almost couldn't bear to watch it. It felt so I should say that from the first time I acted professionally, I don't love watching myself back anyway. I always can see things, oh God, why did I make that choice? Could I have done something differently? But with this one in particular, it felt really strange because there wasn't a script and it had been kind of a slightly feverish period of time that we made it. It was almost as if someone had recorded your voice without you realising and then playing it back. And you're like, did I really say that? Like, I couldn't quite remember.
Yeah.
I had a vague idea of what we did, but not the specifics. So it felt really strange watching it back. And it took the kind of the second time watching it through to be able to kind of be a bit more comfortable and actually almost, you know, engage with it a bit more and enjoy certain aspects of it. But it felt very... yeah, it's very quite voyeuristic, the feel of it. I felt that with the others as well, but when it's yourself, it's very strange.
It does feel very... But also because the first scene is shot in the Regent's Park Rose Garden, isn't it?
Yes.
Which I recognise very well from walking from the station. I was like, I know where that is and I know that bench. But there's a real sort
of... Have you sat on that bench?
Yeah.
Just in honour of the film.
Yeah, well, of course, naturally. Sit there, read the inscription. Did you read the real inscription?
It was the real inscription. Did you find that bench? Oh, I see. I was being directed towards that bench.
That's right. I mean, this is what I love about it. Again, all of it feels slightly like fate as well. Mm. The right things happen in a way that you've not dictated it should happen, but it happens because you've put elements in place with lots of different kind of elements in place with the hope that something's going to be provoked by it, and if it does, it's great. If it doesn't, there's something else will happen that you've also sort of semi-decided but not absolutely as well, because, you know, in choosing where you shoot as well, it's really, really quite really important actually as to what that does to the actors, what the feeling is in that, you know, and that Rose Garden was chosen because there is a sense of a kind of very cliched sense of romance with roses and sort of slight beauty about it, sort of, you know, and there's something that's the atmosphere of it is dictating in some ways how that scene might play out, and actually there was something really precious about it. I thought, you know, there was something that did affect you. You know, that's what I loved about it.
Yeah, I got over my initial thought, gosh, this is a bit cheesy.
You shot it chronologically, didn't you? So that would have been
because
you presumably have to get up to being comfortable in this character's skin. Well, I mean, which scene was there a particular scene that you found difficult? I mean, I'm wondering whether it was, for example, there's one where you're dancing in the apartment, and personally, I would have died if I'd had to do that. But I don't know. Perhaps you dealt with it far better.
I was aided by a couple of glasses of wine. So not just a prop.
That was real wine, wasn't it?
It was real wine. I said, I need real wine for this scene. What did I find? I suppose the scenes I found. Well, that we found trickier were ones that were, there were scenes where it seemed we found quite quickly the way, the feel for them and how they should go. And it was the scenes where it wasn't quite so obvious and there were many different ways that you could play them were tougher because, you know, we could have done them many different ways.
And we had lots of late night conversations about why we felt it wasn't quite there and just ways. And we were just talking all the time throughout the shoot about, you know, because you're trying things all day and at the end of the day, we're very, very tired. But at the same time, you know that there's something that you haven't quite got to with. And so you just want to find a way to resolve it that's going to be satisfying and where you haven't, you know, because you say rightly, yeah, some things just really flow and it's, or you don't quite know what they are, but there's something about them that you just feel, yeah, we've achieved something there. Mm. But other scenes which are just a bit more challenging and you know, for some reason don't quite come alight, and then but you always find a way where they do, because mm-hmm. you keep trying. And that's you wouldn't do that with normal drama making. It is what it is. You move on. Yeah. Thank you. You know, but with this, you can always revisit and try again, try mm-hmm. differently. You know, and it's a proper organic journey.
And is this something that you will revisit? Like, we've had three episodes of this. Is there a plan to do more? Do you feel that you've done or achieved what you set out to achieve with this?
Never done.
Always a work in progress.
I just keep wanting to make work in a way that feels it has an importance to an audience as well. What I've been most satisfied is there's a sense in which they are connecting and making people feel that they are not alone in what they're experiencing, mm. that they can see these films and they feel a resonance with them. There's a truth to them and a resonance that makes them say, well, yeah, I know that. I know this, what this is. And there is some way through it. There is a way out. Because mm. they're all about a change within each character, that a change for the better, ultimately. So that's the work I keep wanting to make, really. So it's ongoing.
Fantastic. Mm. Well, Dominic Savage, Gemma Chan, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
Thanks.
That was Gemma Chan and Dominic Savage, and you can catch the excellent I Am Hannah on Channel 4 on Tuesday night at 10 p.m. Do not miss it. On now to this week's reviews, and first up is, oh yes, Euphoria. Now, looking forward to might not be the term for this one, but we've certainly been anticipating this for quite a while now, since it debuted in the US in June. Dubbed the American Skins, this is an ensemble teen drama from Sam Levinson, which is fronted and narrated by Zendaya. It's actually based on an Israeli series of the same name and follows a group of high schoolers. But unlike most TV teen shows, this is awash with graphic sex, drugs, trauma, cocks, and basically all the things that the dad in 10 Things I Hate About You was trying to warn Julia Stiles about. So to say you shouldn't watch this on public transport, a fact, I might add, that I learned to my peril, is something of an understatement. Isn't that right, Boyd?
Yes, also not to be watched in the office, really, because my desk, where people are wandering past me all the time, so I'm watching it and there's a scene where the dude's in the shower at school and there's literally...
Is that the 30 cock
30 people, naked guys, teenagers wandering around with their dicks out, among other moments. There's also a huge number of erect penises, which is very rare for any TV show.
But are we saying they're prosthetics?
Well, there's definitely a prosthetic one in episode one.
Which is a picture, isn't it?
Yeah. But most of them are admittedly shown as like on people's pictures on their phones.
Disembodied.
Exactly. But still, you don't see them.
You don't see
them very often.
In situ.
You don't see them. You don't see in situ, so to speak. No, I'm not saying that there's loads of actors getting their erect penises out. But there's an image, recurring image that does happen throughout the series, interestingly. And I think that's part of the whole conception of this from the creator, Sam Levinson, which is that it's partly about porn culture and that the influence that has on all these young people these days. Because it is absolutely the case that teenagers can access proper hardcore pornography with erect penises and everything. So I think, you know, it's not just there to shock. And I think this is the case that there are scenes, including the famous 30 penis scene, which is the beginning of episode two, which are shocking in many ways. But I do think they're not gratuitous, because it's part of the whole conception of the piece. And I think what is incredible at the show, there's lots of elements of it that are controversial, but what I do think, it's a properly authentic look at the current state of teenage life when it comes to sex and relationships and drugs and the issues there is. Now, you might say, well, how the fuck do I know? But I vaguely do know some young people in this country.
I know the young people.
Boy,
you are the dad from 10 Things I Hate About You.
But it certainly comes across to me as addressing what it's actually like. And that is really rare, because I think, you know, there's lots of shows featuring teenage life that kind of, when it finally comes down to it, they've got to shy away from it a bit. They don't want to get... But this doesn't shy away from anything.
I think the...
But what's even more important is that the characters that it's built around, Zendaya is the main character, Rue, who is a recovering drug addict. At the beginning, she comes out of rehab, etc. She's such an involving, engaging, incredibly acted character, and she narrates the whole thing. And interestingly, she narrates everyone else's story as well as her own, which I found an interesting device. She's a fantastic character, brilliant performance. Her best friend, who she meets in the first episode, and they go on to have a really interesting friendship, is also Hunter Schafer, brilliant performance as Jules. She's incredible. And the main dude character, who's this teenage guy who's the son of this horrendous guy who owns everything in the local town.
Eric Dane,
who we see in the first episode committing statutory rape because he has sex with an underage girl. And his son is...
Trans girl.
And his son is incredibly troubled because he went and looked at his dad's porn collection, and he has all these issues because of toxic masculinity, etc. His character is fascinating and much more intriguing and layered, textured than the usual jock figure. I've seen 4 episodes and I think it gets better and better and better. And I do think it's a brilliant show. I think, I read the reviews in America and they almost like got obsessed with the shock elements of it. And that's fair enough because they are pretty unusual and amazing. But as a show with really well-drawn characters, fascinating subject matter, really interesting dialogue and believable dialogue, and episode 4, which is almost like a set piece set in the fairground where all the characters kind of come together and big revelations occur, and it's really disturbing. It's almost like a horror film. It's an incredible hour of TV, and I think it's a brilliant show.
See, what I think is interesting about this is that the shock value for me is not, like, what's shocking is not what they've done with the TV show. What's shocking is this is the world that teenagers now live in, and that this is a realistic depiction of what they have to encounter. And, you know, at the risk of sounding wildly out of touch, which of course I am, is, you know, the normalization and ubiquity of drug use, and the fact that, as you say, porn culture has permeated the psyche to such an extent. And I thought the most disturbing scene in the first episode, and a very upsetting scene, is one where it's at a party and the guy and the girl are about to have sex, and then they start having sex and he's choking her. And Rue essentially pauses the video and says, like, before you comment on this, it's not that he's a bad guy, but you need to understand the world we live in. And she shows you, this is what men's idea of sex is, and she shows you a very quick cut montage of scenes of degradation and misogyny from male-led pornography, which is horrific. And so is it any wonder that these sort of young men, whose only real, you know, visual understanding of sex has come from this kind of pornography, think that it's okay to be choking a girl out during sex? Like, it's absolutely obscene. And I love the fact that this show doesn't shy away from that and just faces it head on and says, look, this is a serious fucking issue, and this is the kind of stuff that goes on, you know. And kids will recognize this fact and hopefully, you know, help contextualize it, but also for those, you know, old bald white men such as ourselves, we can be fucking horrified by it. In fact, I watched you watching this scene in the office. The expression on your face when you were watching it, you looked as horrified as I felt when I saw it.
But you're right, because that is really one of the most kind of, I suppose, on the nose moments when you realise what they're doing in terms of taking apart teen culture and taking apart teen dynamics, and what has led to the kind of, some of the breakdown, I think, between girls and boys. And what you see from that whole porn setup is the expectations placed on both boys and girls, because actually he's like, oh fuck, well, I thought you probably liked it. Yeah. And then she becomes quite compliant, and you realise that actually what you see set up in porn, as you rightly say, is kind of a submission of the woman and this kind of dominance and physical dominance and violence of men. But I agree with you in that I think the way it kind of tackles everything, you've got addiction, you've got porn, you've got body image, you've got slut shaming, you've got trauma. It isn't, I kept thinking about 13 Reasons Why and actually why it did everything so much better than 13 Reasons Why. Because it's very frank, it is shocking in moments, but it's not trying to shock. It's not trying to have these moments where you're like, holy fuck, what just happened? And parents are like wringing their hands. It felt like a necessary, every single moment when you're shocked, it is making a fundamentally important point. And actually, they do it with real sensitivity, just with real honesty. So, I mean, but it's so bold creatively. It opens on this incredible monologue of her being born. And you're like, what the I haven't seen anything like that
what
in telly.
Is happening? Yeah.
And she describes coming out of her, being crushed by her mother's cervix on the way out of the birth canal. And at that point, you're like, we're not in fucking Kansas anymore, Toto. Like, this is a different thing. And it is sexy in parts. It's soapy in parts. It's explicit. It's so stylized. but it is not without substance at all. And I think it doesn't take the easy path on any of it. I thought what was really interesting is how they looked at addiction. So she is post-rehab. It'd be really easy just to dismiss her as a druggy kid who, you know, has this privileged life and what does she really know? And there's an amazing, again, a monologue from her where she's talking about how she feels when she's on drugs and kind of, and it's not even, and it sounds, in the wrong hands, it could have sounded like almost like suicidal ideation. But what you realise she's after and she's hunting for is absence and safety in the absence and just kind of an escape from the reality because she's felt like she's been unhappy her entire life. And I actually thought the way they described addiction and why kids seek escape like that was unlike anything I'd ever heard. I can't remember it ever being framed in those terms, which kind of makes you a really invested in her. I agree with you, Boyd. She's so compelling as a character. Like Zendaya is fucking, it's like she was made for this role. You're like, why were you in that Spider-Man film again? Because suddenly you're like, but so I just think it has such an interesting perspective on everything, whether it is statutory rape, whether it's sexual assault. There is no kind of clear cut path through anything. And as you said, there was a moment where I was like, fuck me, I'm old. But there is this sense of authenticity and almost voyeurism on our part. As an adult watching it, you're like, oh my God, is this what kids today are really battling through, this trauma that they're living with and this kind of the demands and that modern society particularly put on them that we necessarily didn't have put on them.
Absolutely.
I think it's
the
brilliant.
The other incredible overriding thing I think is privacy, is the lack of privacy.
Yeah.
And I think that really came home to me because I was thinking, you know, when I know, obviously, as we've said at the beginning, how white and privileged we us two are, particularly middle class, and I had a very, you know, easy time with things and everything, but you always have, no matter what happens to you, but back in the day, you always had your privacy effectively.
Yes.
And it was never even, you never even thought about it. These people and everything that happens to them is being filmed.
Yeah. So
by their people on the
guy who's
phones.
Shagging the guy in the swimming pool to make a boyfriend jealous. And there's three guys, fucking perverts, filming on their phones.
Yeah.
Because of course they are.
Yeah. And even, there's a brilliant bit where it deals with like revenge porn or just.
Yeah.
And it's dealt with it like. Yeah. And you think, oh, this is going to be an ongoing. It's kind of dealt with almost matter-of-factly, but so much more believably, I thought, because it's such a common occurrence now. But as you say, it's incredibly beautifully made. There's a thing, I think it's in episode two, where one character, and I won't spoil it, so one male character has an online phone text relationship with another female character, and this plays out in this incredible sequence where splits the screen and they're texting at each other, and it's honestly I've never seen anything like it because you see all kinds of visual representations of texting these days,
and they're normally shit, right?
And they're normally shit. This is so amazingly done, and it's so clever how, you know, the pauses between someone thinking, oh, what shall I say now, and you have to keep the speed of the conversation going. These pressures on these people, oh my God, it is like a nightmare in some ways, and yet it's so brilliantly done, and there's brilliant humor, it's a kind of remarkable thing that it is addressing all of these things in such an incredibly believable yet entertaining and brilliantly done way.
This feels almost like a natural evolution of Eighth Grade. Did you see Eighth Grade?
Yes.
Like Eighth Grade doesn't have this hypersexualized element because it takes place at a slightly younger age bracket, but it showed what it's like to be a kind of like a tweenager or whatever that sort of is. You go in between 10 and 13, you know, coming into the digital world and being immersed with social media and lack of privacy and all of these things. And that, frankly, was just discombobulating. And to go from that and then saying, oh my God, and then when you layer in, you know, sexuality and porn culture and full adolescence, it's like, fuck me, I'm glad to be a lot older and not having to deal with this shit. I'm glad the internet wasn't around when I was, you know, a kid, is all I'm saying. Whatever, granddad.
Yes.
So watch it for the social commentary, watch it for the verisimilitude, watch it for the sea of erect penises, but do watch it. It is Euphoria, and it airs here on Sky Atlantic on Tuesday, August the 6th at 10 p.m. Next up in our rehab sequence is This Way Up. This is a new comedy written by and starring Aisling Bea as a woman fresh out of rehab who's trying desperately to get her shit together. It co-stars Sharon Horgan as her slightly more together sister, and this lands on Channel 4 this Thursday. Terry, this sounds like something that would have absolutely floated your boat.
It did in the main. As you say, it is also a post-rehab story, but this is slightly different in that she was in rehab for a nervous breakdown, which is essentially what they kind of agree she was in for. Starts really hilariously. They're at the reception desk and you think they're checking out of a hotel, yeah. And it turns out they're moaning that there's no jacuzzi like there was on the website, and it turns out they're in a rehab center. So I will say Aisling Bea and Sharon Horgan have amazing chemistry. You really can believe they're sisters. They have a really brilliant intimacy. The timing between them, the delivery, they work beautifully together. There are some lovely details in the writing of this, and I think Aisling Bea has done an amazing job. She's a teacher, and there's an amazing scene where she's using the Kardashians teach them English, and it's just they don't explicitly say at any point, I'm now going to use the Kardashians, but you gather from the rhythm of the scene what she's doing, and it's just beautifully understated and played. It felt, I suppose my only thing is, and I've only seen the first episode and they are only 30-minute episodes, is it felt a little slight to me and it felt a little thin. And I think the first episode, maybe because it's got so much establishing work to do, it really relies heavily on the humour more than anything. Mm. There's one particular scene that I won't ruin, but it's in a bathroom and it starts out flipping and it ends up quite heartbreaking, and that I got quite excited by that.
Misery, not in a bad way,
but I was like, oh, I kind of get tonally where this is settling down to, which is this kind of pathos and this heartbreak really at the heart of what is kind of at many points it is reliant very heavily on comedy and on the kind of interactions between them. And it's essentially a story of a woman trying to make sense of the absolute messiness of life, and that really, really comes across, and you're really compelled by her immediately. You're really invested in her and want her to be okay. It's an amazing kind of oh God, please don't do it almost sex scene, which is hilarious. Huh. There's like lots of little amazing scenes. I kind of left at the end of it feeling a little bit underwhelmed, and as I say, that may be because I need to watch more episodes and I'll get fully into the rhythm of it. I think it's got amazing promise. I do think it's really funny. I think the writing's great. I just didn't absolutely love it.
I'm lucky enough to have seen four episodes. Mm. And I think, and taking on board everything you said, I do think it does get more and more confident, and the tone becomes more emphatic.
Yes.
And the storylines envelop you, is that a word, as it goes on. So, for example, there's a relationship that unfolds between her and this guy, played by Tobias Menzies, who's in mourning for his wife.
Yes.
And their little son, who's this little French boy who's adorable, and she ends up being his private tutor. And that, the way that plays out, adds a whole new element to the thing, which is really brilliantly done. It's kind of, I hate using the word sweet, but it is sweet, and yet it's not cloying and sentimental. It's fantastically observed, that thing that goes on. Her students come into it more. In episode two, there's a great storyline about one of the students that touches upon Brexit, and you know, without, and all this sounds like it sounds like slightly clumsy. It does deal with things very, very entertainingly and amusingly, but poignantly as well. And then when you see more and more of her life, and particularly and her and Sharon Horgan together, those scenes, every single one is spectacular and incredibly funny. They do a performance of Zombie in
episode, the cranberries
Zombie, which is fucking incredible. So I think, and she said, I think in interviews she said, Aisling Bea said she got more confident as she was writing this. So by the time she gets to five and six, she says, oh, you know, they're much better than one and two. She's very aware of that. But I think it's a really special thing in the end. And I think it's up there with all the best, you know, comedies we've talked about in recent times. It's beautifully filmed. You know, again, it's got a real atmosphere to it. I think London uses London locations really well. There's a kind of glowing neon-y thing going on, and really interesting choices. Like the scene, you know, in the very first thing you talked about, you think they're checking out the hotel.
Yeah.
And there's a shot where Sharon Horgan's in focus and Aisling Bea's totally out of focus. So that was a really clever thing of kind of commenting on how she's kind of a fuzzy almost moment and she doesn't really know what's happening to herself. There's little moments like that. I think it's a really ambitious thing, and I think there's honesty to it that is excellent. So I love it. I think it's brilliant.
I thought it was great as well, actually. I you can tell the first episode is still finding its feet, but that's the case for a great number of first episodes.
How many did you watch?
Just the first one.
I think it's tentative when you were saying then about it growing in confidence. I can see that, because it felt when it was edging towards those interesting bits of tone, it almost kind of pulled back. That scene I'm talking about, it cuts out of it very quickly after it kind of shifts in tone.
It's trying to establish,
watch
isn't
some
it?
More,
no, I'm definitely going to watch more of this. I love it. I love the fact that knowing that the part of Shannon was written for Sharon Horgan, I think that comes across really clearly. And sometimes, like, it's as I think Ashlyn B said, that she was trying to write it so that it's Sharon, but also not lean too much into the catastrophe Sharon, who's, I think, slightly more abrasive and self-centered. And in this, she comes across, and it's weird trying to reconcile it. Like, in this, she comes across as, you know, much more empathetic and sort of caring as the older sister who actually has it together. But I thought she was, as a character, that B's character is a kind of like a sort of a lovable fuck up slash hot mess kind of person. Like, really, really, really worked. What?
Oh, God. All that hot mess stuff. See, this is my only thing, right? You've pressed the button wrong.
I should never have said hot mess
button. You idiot.
This is my only thing, right? Is people are all going to say this, right? They're going to go, oh, it's the new Fleabag. Oh, it's the new game face. Oh, it's the new, you know, woman who's a mess trying to make it out of her lives. Oh, she's a hot mess. Like, sorry,
I'm thinking they're going
to go, I was like, don't say those words, James. I kind of feel like those shows have all such difference between them. And I, you know,
no, I know what you're saying. I heard a critic who I'm not going to name this week on the radio.
Boyd Hilton.
No, talking about how this is kind of complaining that this is another show showing women who are, whatever you want to call them, hot messes, or not showing them the most positive light. And I thought it was such a, and I'm not saying this about your part, but
thank you, Boyd.
I thought that was such a lame point, because this is different. And we've already said how game face, she's not a hot mess. I think this is dealing with a very specific issue, which is loneliness.
Yes.
And her breakdown happen because you'll find out more about that. You meet her ex and all of that, but she's feeling lonely and alone, as opposed to her, you know, more successful, etc., sister who's got, you know, lavish apartment, boyfriend, everything. And that is a thing you don't see explored very often. That's not explored in any of these other shows we've talked about. It's a thing that is a big theme of this show, and that's a unique thing. And you don't have to be a hot mess to feel lonely. And I think loneliness is an incredibly common feeling among men and women, and that's what this is dealing with a lot.
But do you just feel people feel there's a flux of these women, right? Because women have been represented in an idealized way on screen for generations. Yeah. And then suddenly you go, oh, let's have an honest conversation about what it's like to be a woman, about fertility, about loneliness, about drinking, about sexual promiscuity, whatever it is, right? And about depression and all these things. And suddenly you lift the lid and women start to feel empowered to tell their stories. And everyone goes, oh, put the lid back on. We don't want another hot mess popping up. No, to your point, each one of those shows and each one of those female characters is actually entirely different. It's just a woman who doesn't have her shit together. Fucking spoiler alert, mates. Women don't have their shit together quite a bit of the time.
And they're all comedies. In the history of comedy, all comedies are about people who don't have their shit together. Yeah. Of course they are.
And it's also a vehicle of truth.
You don't do all the comedies with blokes who don't have their shit together. We've forgotten all those. If you have a program of comedies about people who do have their shit together, successful people who never have issues in their life, no one's going to watch any of that. So it's an intrinsically stupid point.
Comedy history is full of men who don't have their shit together. Life is full of men who don't have them. That's a different point. Carry on. Sorry, James.
Okay. It's possible that got through. Ladies and gentlemen, that is an example of why you should always choose your words very carefully around Terry White. I was in no way implying that this was like all the other shows. At no point did you hear me say the new Fleabag. No, it's a thing in and of its own self.
It was hot mess.
Yes, yes.
It's such a reductive phrase. Hot mess.
What
does it even mean?
I redact the term hot mess.
Oh, she's a hot mess. And I'll
retract,
tell you what.
You mean? You can't redact it. It's too late for that.
And I tell you what, the term hot mess is only ever used about women. When was the last time you said hot mess about Chris Hewitt from Empire?
Just for example.
Let's take that term back. I'm reclaiming the term hot mess. It is no longer about women. It is not gendered. This is an all-purpose term.
Oh, amazing.
We'll get t-shirts made. Pilot TV t-shirts to say, I am a hot mess.
Oh my God, that would be amazing.
Let's do it. We'll take them to the live show when we do it, which incidentally will be happening at the King's Place, the London Podcast Festival, on Friday, the 13th of September of this year. Book your tickets now. We'll do our best to get that merch available for that time. Wow. Okay, so that was This Way Up, the new show from Ashlyn B. And that airs on Channel 4 on Thursday, August the 8th at 10 p.m. If you are going to watch it, please don't do it with Terry or it will end badly for you. Lastly, this week, we have GLOW, or Gorgeous Ladies of Wrestling, which enters its third and final season this week. For those not already watching, this is a fictionalized series set in the 80s around the eponymous women's wrestling circuit. Ruth Wilder, a.k.a. Zoya the Destroyer. I think she's originally a struggling actress who ends up auditioning for GLOW instead. That's what I'm led to believe.
Correct.
But I've never watched this show before. I've always meant to, but it's kind of passed me by. However, late to the party I may be, but I have, you know, turned up. So I did watch this particular
well done
episode.
You.
But yeah, thank you. Thank you. I made the effort. But rather than hear me talk about a show that, let's be honest, I don't really know anything about other than having seen this episode, let's hear it from Boyd, who I'm almost certain will have been there for the whole journey.
Well, I did watch season one, and the very first scene is when Alison Marie, said she's auditioning for a proper thing.
Yeah.
And her agent, and she doesn't get it. She's furious, and she begs her agent for anything. And her agent's like, will you do, like, you know, soft porn? Or will you do, or will you do maybe, like, wrestling, this wrestling, weird wrestling thing they're setting up? It was a great premise, and I very much enjoyed season one. I have to say, but I did not tune into season two, because even though it was a great premise and it's an entertaining, well-written, well-performed show, there's something uncompelling about it.
It's really boring.
You could say that.
Yes. This is my reaction to it.
Well, I didn't find it really boring, but I clearly didn't find it exciting or compelling enough to watch season two. I'm now back to season three, and I thought this was a quite effective return, because it begins with, it uses the Challenger disaster.
It does.
And I say uses, I mean, it literally uses this real life space disaster.
And footage, the archival footage.
Which some may say, I don't know, you know, too soon.
I was surprised they did that.
I was surprised as well. Mm. And they do make quite blackly comic jokes about it. And that was a good device. I mean, it is a device as a way back into the series. And you have to kind of catch up with the various interrelationships and, you know, who's taking over the running of the show. So a lot of it is about the politics of, you know, this is a women's wrestling group, but men run it. You know, a man played by Marc Maron, you know, produces it and directs it. And then, you know, another man wants to take over it. So there's a lot of that, which is interesting. But the fundamental issue is it's too languid, the storytelling. And I was comparing it to, again, highlighting how good This Way Up is. And in fact, all of these current Channel 4, Game Face, all these shows, forgetting the whole thing we were talking about just now, the issue,
Hot Mess Boy, don't do it.
No,
don't do it.
They're well-written narrative sitcoms that go somewhere. And each episode has storylines and character developments that want to make you keep watching them. This doesn't have that. I'm sorry. I just felt like there's nothing that's going to get me watching it, carry on watching it. As well made as it is, and you know the other thing that annoys me about it? Marc Maron really annoys me now.
Really?
Yeah. I just think he's a grump, and that he's a grump on his podcast. He's a grump here. He plays grumps and everything he does. And I'm like, so what? I don't think he's funny anymore.
Wow.
And I know he's done podcasts with, like, you know, Obama and everything.
Yes.
But I find him really tedious and repetitive.
See, I quite like WTF. Yeah.
That's just a personal issue.
I don't have a problem with Marc Maron, and I wanted to like this a lot. You know, it started well with peppy 80s synth, which I'm always there for.
The music's great.
Yeah. And it had, you know, Alison Brie putting on a slightly upsetting faux Soviet accent. You know, and the challenges disaster kind of wrong-footed me, but all the way through I was exactly what you're saying. I was like, this is well written, you know, it's an interesting concept. I like, it's got a real sense of place and time, but I just can't bring myself to care what's happening. Like, it didn't draw me in. And, you know, again, this is season three. I've never watched an episode before this. I don't know who these people are. Perhaps if I watched it from the beginning, I'd be more drawn to it. But clearly not. But I didn't feel in any way inclined to either A, watch the next episode, or B, go back to the beginning and start again. So I think my GLOW journey began and ended with this particular episode. I was surprised to see Gina Davis in there.
Right, and that was one of the nicest things. It's great to see Gina Davis, but, you know.
Especially when upon one point she's talking about a dance captain called Fluff Lecoq, which is always, you know, entertaining. But really, that and Alison Brie getting caught Boris-like on a zip line were really the high points.
I feel bad that kind of you and I are reviewing this, because I will say that I know loads of people are massive fans of GLOW. Although I will just say that I only learned it stood for
Gorgeous, isn't it? Gorgeous Ladies of Wrestling.
Gorgeous Ladies of Wrestling, when you just said it then.
Oh, okay.
But I tried to watch the first episode of season one and gave up and never went back to it. And coming in at season three, I had no clue what was happening, like less than no clue. I did find the whole dodgy Russian accent while that awful tragedy was unfolding on screen.
I am Alison Brie. I'm watching Challenger Disaster.
That did make me laugh. But I just found it, I was very confused about what was happening. Kind of got that they were now on doing a live show at Vegas, right? Yeah. Which is a completely different setup than it has been previously. I have no fucking clue, to be honest, what was happening, but I didn't want to watch another episode, and that's it.
So, it's a show that's clearly well-regarded. Lots of people like it. Unfortunately, none of them are in this room at the moment, so you are shit out of luck.
And I do feel like we should say that, because I hear from people a lot who really like Glow.
Glowheads.
And maybe if I'd have been in it from the beginning, but I found, what I would say is, if you have not seen any of the previous seasons, you cannot just pick this
up. No, I think you need to start at the beginning, but I'm not sure that we're necessarily recommending it.
I agree with that. It has got its fans, but I think there is a reason it's finishing on this third season. I think it's because it is running out. It's just running out of steam.
It is, as you say, languid.
I thought that was a good use of languid.
Better choice of words there than mine of hot mess. Anyway, so that's Glow, season 3 of which drops on Netflix on Friday, August the 9th. We should also mention, out this week is the fourth and final series of Preacher, which is based on the awesome Garth Ennis comic book. I did actually argue that we should review this one instead of Glow, but Boyd was so taken with the wrestling ladies that he was having none of it.
No, I just, at that noise that Terry just made there.
Hang on.
I said, Terry wasn't Terry wasn't there at the time, and I was like, if you really think Terry's going to want to do the fucking Preacher.
She didn't enjoy Glow either.
I know, but Preacher, season whatever it is, 10.
78. Nobody likes it.
I feel that there's some. See, this is genre bias, is what this is. We've had some reviews on the old iTunes accusing Terry and I of both being terribly narrow-minded. My and my writing off of an entire genre that is reality TV, and Terry for her disdain of science fiction and fantasy.
I mean, it's basically The Expanse and Fire Escape.
I'm first of all looking forward to you reviewing the next season of The Expanse, which you're going to have to do. And also, I'm looking forward to the fact you told me that you would watch an episode of Fire Escape if I chose one for you. So I'm going to do
I'm
that.
I'm still waiting for you to choose
I'm going to do that. All right, fine. Before next week, I will think of an episode of Fire Escape for you.
Okay.
I will bring it along next week and I will announce it then.
Okay.
And then you can watch it off. So you have a week off. You don't have to watch it this week. You watch it next week. But hang on, we've got slightly derailed from this. What I was going to say is, like, so Preacher, I watched the first two seasons of Preacher and actually thought it was decent, but I kind of didn't watch season 3 because I got a bit bored. Mm. So I don't know really. I mean, it's wrapping up. Like, season 4, which is just starting, is the last one.
What are you on about?
Preacher. Sorry. Final season of Preacher. Right. Terry, who was doing emails, wasn't really listening, but okay, fine. So to anyone who does still watch Preacher, you know, you should probably watch this. It's the final season. But, you know, and you can catch up with Jesse Custer and the gang as they do their final. Anyway, it's on Amazon Prime from Monday. So, you know, go nuts.
It's not as good as The Boys, which is the good adaptation of a thingy comic book.
There's nothing wrong with this one. It's fine.
It's not as good.
It's fine. All right. Anyway, so what's our pick of the week? It's Preacher. Excellent. Let's move on. I know. What are we saying pick of the week is? Are we saying, I suspect it's Euphoria?
100% it's Euphoria.
It is Euphoria, but This Way Up is fantastic as well.
Yeah. Okay. Fine. Right. Finally, before we go, it's time for the Banshee segment, which, if you've not been with us from the beginning, is so named because the first show we did in it was Banshee. There you go. Because it stuck. Anyway, this is the bit where Boyd and I cast an eye back over the bajillions of hours we've spent staring at screens to recommend an older show that you might not have seen, or if you have, you might want to revisit, and then Terry pisses all over it. Boyd, what's yours?
Well, I was inspired by the fact that Indira Varma is in This Way Up.
Yes, she is.
One of the excellent people in it, and she plays Sharon Horgan's character as kind of confidant, and they have the other thing which I forgot to mention, they have a really interesting developing friendship as the show goes on. And Indira Varma is brilliant in everything she's in.
Indeed.
And she was in a crime drama, whodunit, called What Remains, which went out about 5 or 6 years ago on BBC One. It was a four-parter. I absolutely loved it. It starred David Threlfall as the detective character, who's like quite an eccentric detective, and David Threlfall is fucking brilliant. And the case he's investigating is the body of a young woman found at the top of a huge big mansion house in London, and she'd been dead for 2 years and no one noticed. And
is that based on a real story?
Well, it's a little bit inspired. There are examples of it, But so it's a little bit inspired by it, but this is a completely separate fictional case. And then all of the different inhabitants of this huge mansion house, all the separate flats where they live in, all the different characters become suspects. And it's a classic whodunit, but really, really well done. I have to... Russell Tovey's in it. Indira Varma's in it.
Did you hear that, James? Russell Tovey's in it.
Indira Varma.
Boy's choice.
Stephen McIntosh, Denise Goff, and others. And it's really great. And it's proper, down, deep, dirty crime whodunit that Terry's going to love if she got the chance to watch it.
Is it BBC?
It was BBC, yeah.
Hmm.
Wow.
Beat that, Baldy.
Right, okay, so My Banshee. And I'm cheating slightly this week because it's a show I think a lot of people have seen. In fact, I know a lot of people have seen it, but it was a while ago. But more importantly, I'm seriously considering a rewatch, so I kind of want to talk about it. So I want to talk about Spooks. So
what?
I want to talk about Spooks.
Not Banshee.
It's a Banshee.
I'm not even saying anything. I don't need to say anything.
Wait, one of BBC's flagship primetime shows.
Yes. Yes.
Okay.
Yes, that one.
I'm just seeing back.
It was from a while ago. Some of our younger readers, listeners might not have been alive.
I mean, Doctor Who was a while ago. But...
So Spooks, or MI5, as it was known in the US, was as you rightly point out, an absurdly popular show that ran for 10 years, from like 2002 to 2011. So this had a slightly revolving cast, but featured, and I'm going to list them at various times, Matthew McFadden, Jenny Agutter, Keely Hawes, David Oyelowo, Rupert Penry-Jones, Hermione Norris, Richard Armitage, Tim McInerney, Percy from Blackadder, Hugh Laurie, Shazad Latif, and of course, Nicola Walker.
Who got their... it can't be a spoiler after 10 years.
The head in
the deep fat fryer.
We're going to get on to that. Also, I should point out, this also starred at one point Alice Krieg, who played the Borg Queen in Star Trek First Contact. Anyway, so there was a raft of incredible people in this show, which was a kind of Le Carré-inspired spy thriller, which told the story of the British security services, but kind of with more of an emphasis on the James Bondy stuff and less on the tedious admin, which, as I'm sure, is most of the job. So what I found fascinating about this show, and I'm sure you guys could remember this, is that its evolution was kind of jarring. In that, do you remember? So, like, season one started off as quite a gritty, hard-hitting spy drama, and the second episode, genuinely at that point, one of the most shocking things that had ever been on television. So, this is the one where Tom McNally shoves Lisa Faulkner's head into a deep fat fryer, and the BBC's complaints office fucking exploded as
but
a result
also
of it.
Them killing her off in such a not a casual way in terms of her death, but you had no sense that they were getting rid of a major.
Oh my
character.
God, no! And they she gets tortured, and then her head, and I can't emphasize this enough, was shoved in a deep fat fryer. And you know, that kind of, I was like, oh my God, like, this is just, what the hell is going on? But then post season one, it became increasingly daft and camp. And like, all of that edge just kind of evaporated. But I think what's kind of interesting is it wasn't less compelling. Like, it leaned into the stupidity and became really, really fun. And it embraced its absurdity and the kind of mission impossibleness of it all. So I think it had serious bits from time to time, but it was really, really enjoyable. So this, as you rightly point out, was a massive hit for the BBC. It was described as, people call it the British 24, I think, pretty much at the time, which I don't think is that unfair. It's not far off.
Is it the British Spooks?
I mean...
It existed as an American show beforehand.
What? No, it didn't.
Did it not?
No, you just made that up. It's not even called Spooks in America. It's called MI5.
Yeah, but it's the same show with a different name.
I don't think that's true.
I don't think so. I didn't know that. Maybe.
I thought it was based on this show.
Feels a lot like something that Terry goes, oh, or maybe that was a dream I had. Do we think? Right, you've got a keyboard. Look it up.
It might be a dream.
Wikipedia. I'm almost certain you've just made that up.
Maybe I dreamt it.
No mention of it being based on
excellent. Excellent. We have debunked that particular myth. But I think we can all agree this did run out of steam towards the end of its 10-year
run. I watched it right up until the end.
Oh, so did I. Did you watch?
I loved it.
Did you watch Spooks The Greater Good in 2015 with Jon Snow?
That was weird.
Yeah,
that
it's like weird. A weird sort of spin-off theatrical movie with Kit Harington in
but
it.
But I was compelled by Harry till the end.
Oh, Harry Pierce. Oh, come on. Love Harry Pierce. Did you know there was a spin-off show for this? Spooks Code 9.
Yes, on BBC Three, I think.
Yeah.
Ridiculous.
My God, was that shit. Yeah. So this was inspired by the success of Torchwood, apparently, and it was like a young Spooks, where it was like a group of agents fresh off their A-levels joining MI5 and getting in adventures. And needless to say, it was
absolute arse and lasted 6 episodes. And I mean, although you can still find it.
This is all very well, James, but the fact is you've picked one of the most famous British TV dramas of the last like 20 years. And not only that, you've spoiled one of the best things that happens in it.
It's in the second episode.
Yeah, but still, what's the point of recommending something when you spoil one of the best things?
You can't have it both ways. Either, Boyd, either everyone has seen it so I shouldn't be banshing it, or I'm spoiling it. You cannot have it both ways.
The few people who haven't seen it, you spoiled it for.
Fine. Anyway, for those of you who I haven't spoiled it for, I hardly recommend going back to this. Proper Spooks was really good, and I'm going to watch it again myself. I am planning a big old rewatch, which I'm sure when I do, I shall recount in excruciating detail. These season box sets are available secondhand for about 50p each, if you so want them. Or you can stream the whole lot on Sky Go, and presumably Now TV.
100%.
Yeah.
So here's the thing. I loved Spooks, so in many ways, I should go with James. However, I feel like you've fundamentally broken the rules of Banshee.
It's my game, they're my
by
rules.
By choosing a hugely successful, long-running tentpole show of one of our biggest TV channels. So I think Boyd has to win by the rules of Banshee. Yeah. But I would say both sound like they deserve adding to anyone's watch list.
Does Boyd not get disqualified for shilling for his mate, Russell Tovey?
No, because I was absolutely inspired by Indira Varma, not Russell Tovey. Mm-hmm. He just happens to be in it.
Unlikely story. Fine. And on that sweeping injustice, that is it for another episode of the Pilot TV podcast. If you like that, then you'll love witnessing us firsthand during our live show, which I've already mentioned. London Podcast Festival, Friday, 13th September. Tickets. I actually don't know if this is sold out. It might have done. I have no idea. So it'll be a really exciting surprise for you either way when you go to the website. And if you're in the clicking mood, why not head over to iTunes and leave us a 5-star rating? Now, Sherlock Holmesian genius that I am, I noticed that several hundred of you have given us ratings. However, many, many thousands of you currently listen to the podcast, which means most of you are star withholding bastards. So please address this at once. I'm going to get 1-star ratings for this, aren't I?
Yes, you are.
Please address this at once. Be kind, please. Lest 1,000 tiny fleas infest your undergarments. Hit us up on social media at James C. Dyer, at Terry_White, at Boyd Hilton, and be sure to tune in next week, or don't tune in since that's not really how podcasts work, but be sure to find a way to listen next week when, with any luck, we'll be looking at David Fincher's Mindhunter, all in capital letters, and very possibly giving a second chance to Succession, which returns for season 2. So I'm gonna give that one a second run through, see if I hate it any less this time around. I'll be honest with you, I don't rate its chances. But until then, pilot out.